Hello and welcome on a bright and rainy daylight savings time Sunday morning panel on big data and powering the race for the White House. I know that even with my failing voice and even with the rain, I know we're all very super excited to be here to discuss data mining and data science in the context of this year's presidential election. Another thing you could probably call this panel is Moneyball for Politics. I know I'm a big fan of that movie, and if you are both fans of that and political junkies, you are in the right place today. From social APIs, voter files, consumer data, and transactional data that is being collected by the campaigns themselves, access to data in the political arena is exploding just as it is everywhere else. And that data is increasingly being combined in very interesting ways, using influences from behavioral science, from other places, to really model how the electorate behaves in new ways. And that doesn't necessarily just have to take the format of how you will vote. It could these models could also be used to determine what means of persuasion are best to persuade you to vote for somebody. Could be used to determine whether you'll donate, whether you'll open an email. As we'll see, the possibilities are limitless. Before a few opening thoughts, I'm going to let each of our panelists introduce themselves, starting with myself, your moderator, Patrick Ruffini, president at Engage, a full-service digital agency in Washington. My background in digital politics includes working on the presidential races in the last three cycles and also running digital for the RNC. And Dan?
My name is Dan Soroker, and I never in a million years thought I would ever work on a political campaign. But when I was working at Google as a product manager, I got to see Barack Obama speak, and he talked about all the great things he wanted to do, bringing what we're doing at Google to the government. So I left and joined the campaign as the director of analytics. Subsequently, I've started a company called Optimizely. We make it really easy to do the kind of things we did in 2008 with website A/B testing.
I'm Alex Lundry. I'm the research director at a firm called Target Point Consulting. We brought micro-targeting and predictive modeling and data mining into politics back in 2002. Our very first client was a gentleman running for governor in Massachusetts named Mitt Romney. And when we told him what we could do with data mining and predictive modeling, all of his Bain consultants that were around him looked at us and said, "You mean they don't do this in politics?" And we've been doing it since then. And my firm is, again, working with the Mitt Romney campaign this year, though I am not affiliated with the campaign. Just want to make that clear.
Good to know. Good morning, everyone. My name is Josh Hendler. I'm the global CTO at Hill & Knowlton Strategies. I've been working around politics and data since way back when in 2004. I was on the Kerry campaign and then worked at the DNC. I was the technology chief for the Democratic National Committee and Organizing for America. And before I joined Hill & Knowlton, I was chief technology officer for a startup out of New York called Jumo.
And I'm Kristen Soltis. I'm the vice president at the Winston Group. We are a Republican political strategy and opinion research firm. We do surveys, focus groups for political candidates, nonprofits, corporations. And in this cycle, the firm, though it's a similar dynamic to what Alex just mentioned, my boss is a pollster for the Newt Gingrich campaign, though I myself personally am not affiliated.
Thanks, Kristen. It's been a truism for a while that you can't really manage, you can't manage what you can't measure. And I'm a Republican myself, but my hats really go off to the Obama team for taking analytics as seriously as they do. And this year, the thing that really caught my attention and got me interested in doing a panel like this was a job posting on a site called KDD Nuggets, I think, or KD Nuggets, that is focus on data science and data mining for a data mining scientist for the Obama campaign, which is just about the coolest job title ever, with the exception of the chief scientist of the Obama campaign, Raed Ghani, which I think that's probably a position title that has never been even contemplated before in a presidential campaign. His background is pretty interesting. Not a lot is known about what the Obama campaign is doing because they won't tell you. They're not going to leak their strategy in the press, but people have kind of dug into some of his academic research, and it's really fascinating. He came from Accenture. He's not a political consultant by any stretch of the imagination. He was doing data mining for Accenture, where he was figuring out things like, can we predictively model which health insurance claims are going to be bad, which health insurance are going to be wrong that are going to require us to go back and rework. I mean, if you've ever had this kind of an experience with a health insurance company, you know it's long, tedious, and painful. And add that up over everyone else who's had that same experience, and that's billions of dollars in cost to those companies. So they figured out a way to 10 times better to predict how predict which of these claims would cause these sorts of issues, so they can reduce their cost and save themselves billions of dollars in the process. He's also done extensive work on the consumer, predicting consumer behavior. And so obviously bringing a lot of that insight to the campaign. One of the things, it's speculated. Again, all of this is, we are going to engage in rampant speculation on this panel, because I'm not sure necessarily that anyone on the Obama 2012 campaign will talk. But one of the things it's speculated that they're working on is mining data from unstructured text fields. That could be everything from tweets. It could be a canvasser at the doorstep and transcribing everything that they're saying. Maybe put it into an iPhone, put it onto an iPad. The canvasser takes that text and they put it into this massive text engine to figure out, you know, exactly, you know, across the millions of conversations that are happening, what are the patterns that are recurring again and again and again, and what does that teach us about what the electorate is actually thinking in a deeper way than maybe a poll could, which asks these very binary yes or no questions. But the culture of measurement in the Obama organization, and certainly in the, and I want to say, and certainly in the Republican Party either, the culture of measurement is not new. It started in 2008, and Dan, you were the director of analytics for that campaign. How did all of this get started?
So it really began, I think this is a great example. This is our team out in Chicago. I can walk through these, actually. Our mission for our organization was try to help the campaign make better decisions using the data that we had. And we started off with running a simple experiment, and I'm actually going to show you what that looks like. This is the BarackObama.com splash page back in November of 2007. So if you actually type BarackObama.com into your browser, you'd see this right on the front page. And this is a great example of how we use data to try to improve the messaging, and some of the more effective things we did early in the campaign came out of this experiment. So I want to actually do a live multivariate test in this room in case many of you don't know what that is. And so let me just briefly explain what we did. So this page has two sections. It has a media section here at the top and a button down in the bottom right. And we actually experimented testing different variations of this. And so as people would come to the site, they might randomly see one of the many variations we tested. So I'm going to show you all the variations, and we'll quickly vote in the room which you think had the highest sign-up rate. Here's the list of all the variations. I'm going to show you each one. This is the sign-up button, the learn more button, join us now button, and sign up now. So the quick vote, how many people think the sign up button did the best? Okay, two. Learn more, about 15. Join us now, about 80%. And sign up now, okay, two. So in this room, join us now did the best. I'm not telling you the results yet. I'm gonna show you the media section. So for the media section, we tested three images and three videos. I don't think the audio will work for the videos, but I'll describe what's going on. This is the get involved image here at the top. Keep track of the one you thought did the best. Family image, change image. This is Barack's video. He's saying, hi, I'm Barack Obama. Welcome to my campaign for presidency. Sign up to learn more about campaign events and about our movement for change. This is the Springfield video, which is a short video that was basically a montage of different scenes from early in the campaign. And then this was Sam's video. This is a very emotional, moving video with a soundtrack using clips from the DNC speech in 2004, mixed together with more recent footage. Okay, so of those six, how many people think the Get Involved image did the best? Three? Family image? Five? Change image? 20? Barack's video? 8? Springfield video? 7? And Sam's video? Okay, in this room, it looks like the change image did the best. So the winners were the Learn More button. How many people voted for that? Okay, a few more than last time. And how many people chose the family image? Okay, how many got them both right? Okay, great. So let me dive into the results. So this is actually a great example of how we use data to try to improve what we're doing online. So this is the results of the multivariate test we ran using Google Website Optimizer. And what these results are showing you is that the Learn More button performed better than the original page, and that all of the videos we tried actually performed worse than all of the images we tried. So if you combine all of this, you actually get an improvement of 40%. So from the baseline of 8%, we were able to go up to around 12% in terms of sign-up rate. And we did a holdout experiment to see the impact this had for the rest of the campaign. So this was in November, December of 2007. We took this 40.6%, and that added an incremental 2.8 million people on the email list, roughly of which 10% volunteered, so another 288,000 volunteers. And I think most impressively, another $57 million from the folks on this from the splash page. So that's a great example from 2008. So I want to sort of bring us up to today. This is in 2010, a great experiment that the folks at Organizing for America ran, which was an experiment to try and improve the virality of the Commit to Vote challenge. And here on the left-hand side, you can see the original page. And they used a product that I built called Optimizely to make it basically test the virality and prove it. And I'm going to give you just a couple. I'm not going to vote, but I'm just going to tell you a couple of things they did that actually helped. One of which was to exclude the religious political Facebook permission from the required permissions to use this app. The second was instead of actually, you know, telling somebody just to tell your friends to go out and vote, the tool actually prompted them for the reason why they're going to commit to vote, and that improved the virality by 11%. Just changing one word from inspire to ask improved it about 6%. Then they added optional fields, made clear what things were optional. That improved it by another 5%. And the last thing they did was instead of saying, you know, commit to vote, they actually really personalized the message. And this is something that we'll talk about in a bit, sort of the future of where this is going, which is the idea of personalizing content and showing exactly the right thing to the right person at the right time. And so instead of saying a generic message, they really tailored the commit to vote ask based off of what your friend is saying. So that's a couple quick examples. I'm glad to dive in later, but I'm going to hand it over to our next panelist.
Alex.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. No, actually,
you do. All right. Let's probably do that for everyone.
So my firm comes at it from a slightly different perspective in that we started off in the offline world, right, working with a what we call a terrestrial voter file. And so just to kind of help contextualize a lot of things we're going to talk about, I thought it would be helpful just to give a very quick definition and understanding of exactly what we mean when we're talking about modeling, about building these predictive models. And basically, I think in the most layman's terms possible, modeling is really just taking the data you already have about somebody and using it to come to some informed judgment about who they are. I don't want to say guess. I don't want to say guessment, but come to some informed judgment about whether they're going to vote, so how likely they are to turn out and vote on election day, who they're going to vote for, right, candidate preference, what issues are affecting their vote, and really anything that has any sort of predictable or reproducible behavior. And the example I like to use is let's just say that we're standing on the street corner out here in Austin and a Prius drove by. If you had to guess, how many people would say that that Prius driver voted for Barack Obama? By a show of hands. Okay, almost all of you said that. Well, right, so we already have some sort of intuition and some sort of data about who a Prius driver is. And we can use that to extract some sort of likelihood of how likely they are to vote for Barack Obama. If I asked you to be a bit more rigorous and quantitative about it, you might think back and say, well, how many Priuses have I seen with Obama bumper stickers? How many have I seen with McCain bumper stickers? And then you can extract that out to an actual numeric probability of how likely that individual Prius driver is to have voted for Barack Obama. And so you saw five of them, four of them were Obama stickers, one was a McCain sticker, 80% likelihood. Although I should note, I had to Photoshop that McCain bumper sticker. not very well either. So this is what we do. This is what Target Point and what predictive modelers do, except we do it with just a ton of data. And one of the methods we use are just simple tree-based modeling. And just to give you a sense, it's not just one variable that we're interested in. It's the aggregate effect of a chain of variables. So let's say all you knew about a particular person was that they were a male. How likely would they be to vote Republican? Well, let's just say 56%. These aren't numbers from an actual micro-targeting project, but they're rooted in truth, is what I like to say. Let's just say 56%. Then I tell you, well, that male is actually 50 years old. Okay, well, let's bump that probability up to 59%. Well, what else can we learn? Oh, they're white. Okay, well, we'll bump the white 50-year-old male probability up to 63%. But we need something that's really good that's going to pop it a little bit more. Oh, to drive an SUV. Okay, well, that puts it up to 68%. We're still doing pretty good. We need a real home run variable. What's a really good consumer variable that we can use to make a prediction? They've got a Bible in the household. Okay, yeah, that's really good. White 50-year-old SUV driving, Bible reading man, 85% likelihood to vote Republican. Can we get it closer? They live in Louisiana. They're a white-collar businessman. By the end of this chain of just a few variables, we can predict with a stunning degree of accuracy how likely that person is to vote Republican. And the principle behind this is basically we do a survey, a large sample survey of the electorate, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 people in a state. And we ask them, what party do you identify with? Who are you more likely to vote for? And let's say in our survey, 100 people met this data chain, this data DNA profile, and 94 of them told us, volunteered the information to us that they were a Republican. Then we go to the state and we say, well, there are about 100,000 people in the state that meet this criteria. So we can reasonably infer that 94,000 of them, you know, plus or minus a small margin of error, are Republican. So that's modeling. That's kind of modeling, you know, 101 in 2 minutes. So just so we're all clear on what we're talking about there. And what we do at Target Point, we're doing that in a voter file, right? And we're using that to create direct voter contact lists for turnout and persuasion. So we'll say, here are the 150,000 people that you need to go talk to about taxes. And it's a turnout message because they're really with you already, but they're low on turnout. Or we say, here are the 200,000 people you need to talk to about education, right? And it's a persuasion message because they're definitely voting, but they're soft on support for us. So that's the essence of what we do. So then I wanted to kind of talk about what is happening this cycle that's different from before. Because as I mentioned in my introduction, this predictive modeling has been going on since about 2002, right, at least consistently and in major campaigns. So what's happening this year that's different from before? I think one of the biggest things is this push for data integration. And it goes by a multitude of names in the industry: knowledge management, master data management, data harmonization, voter relationship management. But fundamentally what it is it's the notion that you get rid of walled-off data gardens. And this is a serious problem in political organizations, in that these circles around the edge here, these are kind of a traditional organizational structure for a presidential campaign. In fact, these were the departments in the 2008 Mitt Romney primary presidential campaign: political, finance, strategy, so on. And the problem is that each of these departments had walled-off data gardens, and they weren't interoperable systems. One would collect address one way, one would collect address another way, and you couldn't get the data to talk to one another. And what we're seeing now in this cycle is a push for this data integration, data that is standardized across the organization that flows in, out, and all around the sum total of the campaign apparatus. And in fact, this is something that has been revealed to be a primary objective of the Obama campaign. There was an article in Slate a few weeks ago talking about their Project Narwhal. You know, they use really cool code names for their data projects. Narwhal and Dreamcatcher is the text one that Patrick was talking about before. And it is this notion of creating interoperable data systems. And they're trying very hard to get those data systems talking to one another because they suffered from that same problem of walled-off data gardens in 2008. And they have massive lists, but they're trying to put them all together. And then I think the other thing that we're trying to do this year is we're trying to kind of lower the wall that's dividing the online from the offline world, right? And really, this is just an excuse to show my nieces and nephews and my kids here. But right now, right, I have a profile on Facebook, right, Alex Lundry, but I also have a registration in the voter file that's William Alexander Lundry. I'm registered Republican. It's where I live. But those two don't know about each other, right? And so campaigns are trying to understand this challenge right now. How can we lower that wall? It's a big brick wall, and I would argue there we probably still want some wall to remain, right? There are legitimate PII issues, personally identifiable information issues, that we still want some brick walls, bricks there. But we're removing some bricks this cycle, and there are a few ways that we're doing that. First is just data providers. There are consumer data aggregators and other data providers out there that are working with companies to provide some insight into a person's online behavior, right? You don't actually get the link between the profile and the voter file, but you're getting some insight. Second are targeted display ads. We are now at a point this year, for the first time, where we weren't there in 2008, where you can provide a list to an organization, to a company, and they can serve an individually targeted online display advertisement to that person. Right? And so that's happening this year, and there's some very interesting experimentation with that. The third are Facebook apps, which the Obama campaign is using, presumably to some good effect, is that if you can get people to sign up for your Facebook app, you are then allowing permission for the campaign to use that data, to know that data, right? And so that's an opt-in. And the other form of opt-in that I think we're seeing is just volunteered association. So, right, you have a profile on the Barack Obama social network. You can volunteer your Twitter handle. You can volunteer your Facebook ID. So those are some of the ways that we're removing those bricks slowly. But this, I think, is really where a lot of campaigns want to go, is how can we have seamless integration between your online persona and your offline voter file? And then the last thing that's kind of new this cycle is the battle over the data, especially on the right. It's a notion of who owns the data, who has the data, what can we do with the data to make it smarter and better, right? And so on the left, it's a very interesting dynamic because in 2004, the right were the innovators in this space. Republicans were the innovators in this space with what was called Voter Vault at the time. And there was a perception that the left had really been left behind on this and that they did a poor job of data management in 2004. And then come 2008, by that time, they had established a company called Catalyst, and in many ways leapfrogged the right in terms of their use of data. And so now the right, it's this interesting leapfrog where now the right is kind of scrambling to catch up to Catalyst. And what we're finding is it's not necessarily a catch-up issue, is it's really just competing pluses and minuses of each model. And so right now, you know, the RNC had their, the Republican National Committee had their data centralized inside of their organization, Voter Vault, right? But now they've moved it outside into a company called Data Trust that can be more Catalyst-like. They can share the data between organizations, and that data flows back into that central repository hub, and that way you have some better sense of who's been contacted and who hasn't. And that in the Obama campaign and labor, organized labor, use that to great effect, I think, in 2008. But what's interesting is there's also these competing national voter files. There's a group called FEMIS, which is more conservative-based rather than Republican-based, the Data Trust. And then just the other day, you know, I heard about a new one called United in Purpose, which has a national voter file, and they're data mining it to try to identify unregistered evangelical voters. And so that's another interesting theme to kind of keep an eye on if you're in this big data world and keep an eye on politics, is the competition over data and the resources. Because I think all the campaigns are realizing that it is a strategic resource that it is very helpful to have access to and to leverage for strategic and tactical advantage. So now.
Great. Musical chair.
Great. So Patrick asked me, you know, come and speak about what we think has actually changed in 2012. As I said before, I've been working in politics, data, and technology since 2004, which in this world is actually a pretty long time. And so I really spent a little bit of time thinking, what's actually changed? And I think if you look at the press coverage, a lot of what you'll read is specifically saying, listen, there's all these new amazing technologies, and there's people in a back room, you know, typing away all night, coming up with the best possible algorithm, and using cutting-edge technology to change everything. And there's actually a lot of truth to that, right? That looking at what the Obama campaign is doing, looking at what's happening on the right, much to me being unhappy about it, but actually, you know, there is a lot of new technology that's coming. But when I thought about it, I actually don't think that the story of new technology and cutting-edge algorithms really does a great job of summarizing what has actually changed in 2012 and what's actually different from 2004 to 2008 to 2012. And I think one story that does actually start to capture a lot of these changes is really this question of a gate. And we're talking about gatekeepers. And the story of data in politics has been a story, in some sense, over the long term, about democratization, about trying to take this data, which was really tightly held in a number of ways that I'll go through, and trying to make it more progressively open and open over time. And so this is a story about technology, but it's also a story about people. It's a story about how people are using data. And so I think the first case of gatekeepers that's really interesting to think about is actually campaign staff. So going back, way back when, to 2000, the way that campaign staff would get access to voter lists or canvas lists, so you have a bunch of volunteers that you want to go out and knock on some doors, you're probably going to actually get huge boxes of paper that are shipped to you that have walk lists on them. And, you know, they'll be overnighted to you, and you'll get these big boxes of walk lists, and at the field office, you'll take those paper, and you'll hand it out to volunteers. And obviously, that's not a perfect process. But the really interesting thing about that is that means that all decisions about targeting, all decisions about who's on these walk lists, all decisions about what volunteers use what lists is actually decided by a data guy. It's decided by someone in a back room saying, this is the best thing. You know, we're not really going to distribute data to our staff across the world, or across the country, because, you know, we know best. And I think, in some sense, this has really dramatically changed over the last few years. It's changed from 2004 to 2008, and it's changing again from 2008 to 2012. And that really means giving more access to people across the campaign, and not just staff on a campaign, but actually giving more access to volunteers on a campaign. And this is really, really critical. So one example of this is in 2008, you started to see, really for the first time at scale, you had volunteers that could log in and get a list of people to call and sit there at home and make calls, and they're actually using the voter list at home. And that list was actually pulled automatically for that volunteer, and they're able to have access to that, where a couple years before, that was never the case. Right now in 2012, what we're seeing is we're seeing even more of that. There's a new company now called Electioneer, which is set up to help to actually give people iPhones with Canvas data on them. Or actually, they use Android apps, but we'll see both of these. So people walking around the streets with all this data right on their iPhone and being able to canvass. So it's this really interesting story of being able to, you know, where it used to be the case that only the sort of the guards of data on a campaign were able to actually see voter lists and make decisions. More and more, we're seeing that coming down to the volunteer and staff level. Which I think is particularly interesting, and I think is also sort of a game changer in a lot of ways, that in order to succeed, it means being a little bit more open about your data, right? That if you're keeping all of your data in the back room and not willing to give it to volunteers and not willing to give it to a lot of staff across the campaign, you're actually not going to succeed as much as taking some risks and saying, you know what, we're going to give out some more of this data, even if that means that there's a small possibility that, you know, people across the aisle may get access to this data. And so that's one really, really important trend that we've seen. The other important trend that we're seeing is that political data and voter data itself is actually just becoming more available. One example that I always love to point to is Nation Builder, which is a nonpartisan online platform. And when you sign up for Nation Builder, which is basically free to cheap right now, you actually get free access to a voter file. And that's really mind-blowing. This is something that's never happened before. I know when I was at the DNC in 2005, it was basically only the national parties that had good national voter files. And now we're at the place where you can sign up to Nation Builder, and, you know, is that the best voter file? I have no idea. But just the fact alone that anyone who's anyone can sign up online and get access to the voter file right away is actually a little bit of a game changer. And we've been seeing this progress over the years. You know, there were small moments like the Ohio Secretary of State deciding, you know, instead of having some ridiculous process where you have to fill out a form and send a letter to get a CD in the mail, or way back when, a tape in the mail. But now, actually, the Ohio Secretary of State decided we're going to put the voter file on the website so anyone can download the voter file. So it's small changes like that that we're seeing that are actually really, really important and change the way that politics is done. And as Alex said, the entire landscape of giving access to the voter file in terms of companies has changed. We have companies like Catalyst. We have companies like Target Smart. All the different Democratic state parties actually came together recently to start offering voter file access to other groups. And that's called the voter file co-op. So we're seeing all these new organizations that are popping up because this data is more and more available. As a couple years ago, this data just, you know, it wasn't that available. And a lot of folks who had this data had a real vested interest in not making it available. The other change that I think is really worth noting is technology. So technology is changing. And it used to be that if you wanted to do analysis on a couple terabytes of data, and you know, when you put together the whole voter list nationally, and then you put together all the consumer data, and you put together all your voter contact data, it turns out that you have data on the order of terabytes. And so it used to be the case that if you needed to do analysis on that data, you would need to go purchase a pretty big, expensive solution for data warehousing. Whether that's Teradata or Netezza, there were solutions for this to handle really, really big, large sets of data. But it turns out they were really expensive. So if you wanted to buy something that could, you know, host and allow you to do ad hoc queries across terabytes, you were talking on the order of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars. But now we're seeing more and more technologies like Hadoop and Hive that actually democratize this. That, you know, sure, it's not that cheap to set up a new Hadoop cluster, but it is actually an open source technology. So you're not talking about having to spend gazillions of dollars on licensing. And Hadoop essentially allows you to host and then with Hive query really, really large sets of data across commodity hardware. So you're not talking about buying some really expensive hardware appliance that actually allows you to set up a cluster on servers that you would use for anything else, or setting up a cluster in the cloud. So the technology has also changed such that that being able to do this sort of work is just more and more available every day. I think another really, really dramatic change that we're seeing is a move from the periodic to real time. And this is actually something that is really essential. That if you were thinking about how models have been built historically over the last couple years, you would do a large set of calls, and whether that's, you know, a couple thousand calls, and you would spend all this time building a model, and maybe you would refresh that model one or two times over the course of the cycle. And obviously, that's not really real time, right? That is, you know, we're going to build the model once and then put it on our database and cross our fingers and hope that everything goes to plan. And that's largely been the story of how micro-targeting worked historically. But more and more, we're seeing a shift to the real time. And that sort of is coming out in a couple ways. Number one, more online data is being leveraged as part of building models. And we're building models for online data in particular. And obviously, online data isn't, you know, survey calls, right? Like, if you're going out to the field for a couple thousand survey calls, that takes a while. And it's something which is a snapshot of a moment. But being able to collect data online, that's a stream, right? That's data, you know, has someone clicked on an email? Has someone opened an email? Has someone given you a contribution? All this data is constantly happening. It's happening this moment that the Obama campaign is getting contributions and people are clicking on Obama emails. So the ability to look at that data in real time and start factoring in that data into some of the models that we build is actually really important. And being able to see that data and see changes in real time is something that I think we started to see in 2008, and the Obama campaign did a pretty great job of doing that. But I think we're really going to see a lot of the advantages of the shift from the periodic to the real time in 2012. And then finally, as Alex did a great job of describing models before, I think it's a really important point that the types of models that we're building in 2012 and the types of models we started building in 2010 are actually just different. So historically, there are a couple models that were always built. So, you know, what's the likelihood that someone is going to actually turn out on election day? What's the likelihood that someone is a Democrat versus being a Republican? What's the likelihood that someone's going to support Barack Obama over John McCain? What's the likelihood that someone is actually going to, you know, get a piece of direct mail in their mailbox, open it up, and read it? Pretty low, but we built models to that effect. But we're doing more and more, and the just types of models that we're building are expanding. So one example from 2010 is when I was at the DNC, we built a model to predict the likelihood that someone would unsubscribe from an email that we sent them. Now, whether or not that's the exact right model to build is an interesting question, but it's really interesting in the sense that you can not only build models to predict whether or not someone will respond to a piece of direct mail, but you can build a model to predict whether or not someone will respond to an email. Maybe you shouldn't send someone a fundraising ask if the likelihood is that they're not actually going to give you money. And that's moving from sort of common sense thinking about whether or not to send someone an email to more analytical thinking and data-driven thinking that says, okay, we should send someone an email, and this is the topic that we should send someone an email on. Also, best channel for giving. This is something that's really interesting. You know, is it best to give someone a call? Is it best to send someone direct mail? Is it best to send someone an email? Really thinking about what the best, you know, way of getting someone to give money to you, and what's the best combination of methodologies for getting someone to give money to you. And likelihood to volunteer. So building models that predict whether or not someone will volunteer. And you know, what's the best way to get them engaged. So all of these things are, you know, starting to be used in 2010 and 2012. And I think the interesting point is not that this isn't a seismic shift in how we're building algorithms or using technology. It's more at the margins. And it's starting to bring a lot of the methodologies that we've used specifically on the partisanship and candidate likelihood in 2004 and 2008 to really throughout the campaign, that across every aspect of a political campaign, we're actually starting to be data-driven and starting to think about, you know, how moving beyond how do we think it should work to how does it actually work. So I think that's really the crux of what the changes are in 2012.
So I come from this from a very different perspective than the three gentlemen that spoke before me, in that I work in an industry that's much more old school when it comes to being the data person on a campaign. And yet even with many of these cool new and in some cases a couple cycles old tools for looking at data, even the savviest campaigns are still using a campaign pollster to do surveys of voters to understand things like, how am I doing in terms of the ballot test? Is my support up or down this week? Is my support up or down this month? What voters like me? What types of voters don't? What messages work best? What messages don't? But the fact of the matter is that the world of survey research is changing rapidly. My first question is, first of all, the average survey phone response rate is down around 20% and declining. How many of you have a landline telephone in your home? How many of you have caller ID on that landline telephone? How many of you pick up regularly numbers that you don't know on that caller ID? This is the problem my industry is facing. there are 27% of U.S. households that are cell phone only, and that number is growing rapidly. People are cutting the landline. And even with the, you know, lots of folks having cell phones, it's not just as easy as a pollster calling cell phones. Because the Telephone Consumer Protection Act of 1991 makes it very, very difficult for me to do so. I'm not allowed to auto-dial a number. I have to have someone manually enter the number. I'm not allowed to call between certain hours. So I don't know if that phone number that I'm calling that's a California number, that person could well be in New York City. It could be 3 hours off. I could be calling them in the middle of the night. I also don't know if I'm trying to reach, say, cell phone numbers based out of Florida. I have a 407 phone number because I'm from Orlando, but I don't live there anymore. But it's likely that a pollster calling cell phone numbers in Florida could think that I was a potential voter and call me. So there's a lot of complication facing my industry and the very small sorts of data that I deal with. Luckily, online research tools are emerging. You have a lot of firms that are building sort of online panels where they can reach out to large numbers of folks, conduct a survey online, and then model that back to look a little bit more like what a telephone survey might look like. So that's emerging, but I really think that that's not necessarily the question of where this industry needs to go. And whether online works really depends on what you want to measure. There are still folks that say that a lot of these online survey tools aren't perfect for measuring things like ballot share. So as it gets harder to ask people questions, I think that the challenge to survey researchers dealing with campaigns is how do you get better about listening? How do you get better about looking at unstructured text data? How do you get better at listening to what conversations are going on in social media to figure out what a campaign needs to know about their level of support, who's supporting them, and what messages are moving them. Now, it's very tough to do this. And sort of the example that I'll give that kind of begins to throw off the ability of folks to do sentiment analysis is Christine O'Donnell in the Delaware Senate race in the 2010 cycle. One of the first things that folks have started to say that we need to look at in social media to understand how well a candidate is or isn't doing is what's the volume of conversation going on about them. But volume of conversation or volume of searches doesn't necessarily translate into volume of votes. This is just a really basic graph from Google Insights to show that you'll see it at pretty much no point in time during the election, once Christine O'Donnell received the nomination, did she have fewer people searching for her on Google than her Democratic opponent. And yet, on Election Day, it really wasn't even close. So just looking at volume of conversation in that race wasn't good enough. So the next thing is to look at sentiment. Now, there are a lot of tools out there that can very easily give you an analysis of sentiment of what's going on, for instance, on Twitter. You know, I can go to twittersentiment.appspot.com, and I can get an analysis. So in the example I've shown here, I've used Gingrich. That is my firm's the candidate that they work with. And tried to get this a brief little sentiment analysis on recent tweets. And what made me laugh was the first example that it gave me as a positive tweet was from someone saying, "Awesome quiz. Who said it, Newt Gingrich or Buzz Lightyear?" This was coded as a positive tweet, and it could be. It might not be. I don't really have enough information to know if that's intended as a positive statement, if that person likes Newt Gingrich, if that person is going to vote for Newt Gingrich. Not to mention the fact that if I'm a pollster for the Gingrich campaign, right now I care about voters in Alabama and Mississippi because those are the primaries that are coming up. I don't know where that person's from. Maybe I know where they tweeted from, but I don't know that they're a registered voter in the state of Mississippi or Alabama. So it doesn't give me the complete amount of information that I need as a pollster to give strategic guidance. Looking a little more scientifically, there's a very reputable firm in Washington that I read in Politico Playbook on Super Tuesday talking about Gingrich. The Gingrich had 6% more activity than other candidates. The positive sentiment on him related to Super Tuesday is at 84%. So this would lead you to believe that online, by looking at all of this data, shouldn't Gingrich be doing great? But on Super Tuesday, of the 10 states that voted, he won one of them. So my point isn't to rain on the parade of sentiment analysis and looking at data. My point is that my industry needs to get better about doing it. We had an interaction recently with another consultant where we came in to describe that a candidate wasn't doing very well in a certain state, that our sample of 800 registered voters showed that they had lost momentum, that things weren't going very well. And there was another consultant that was doing sentiment analysis. And he said, things are going great online. Your candidate has a lot of positive conversation. And quite frankly, my sample is 3.2 million. The pollster's is only 800. So choose who you want to listen to. Now, as on Election Day, the poll was right. The sentiment analysis was wrong. It's not to say that sentiment analysis is always wrong. I just think it's different and that people need to be cognizant of what the differences are between the old school fuddy-duddy survey and where things are moving and how, as they move in that direction, we can apply the sorts of things that pollsters do to be smart about their data to how we look at larger sets of data coming from things like unstructured text to give good advice to candidates. Surveys have landline biases, but sentiment analysis can have an online or an activist bias. There are plenty of folks who are more than happy to go to a voting booth and pull a lever on Election Day, but they're not posting about it on Facebook, if they're even a member of Facebook. So it's important to recognize that neither method of understanding public opinion is perfect. That a survey creates a contained universe, and sentiment analysis can have a variable universe. I don't know how many Delaware registered voters were tweeting about Christine O'Donnell. I know how many people were tweeting about Christine O'Donnell, but I don't know how many of them actually matter on Election Day. A survey can give you concrete results, whereas sentiment analysis, again, the Buzz Lightyear tweet, it can be a little more open to interpretation. However, as Josh was saying, a survey is just a snapshot in time. It takes a lot of time to get it. You have to get all these people on the phone. Where sentiment analysis, I think, can be really cool because it can be real time. It can be evolving. It can give you information in the moment in the campaign about, you know, if your candidate gave a speech that day and all of a sudden things are starting to look a little better. As algorithms get better to determine what is a positive and negative tweet, I think that will be a very cool way to for campaigns to know immediately if their messaging is working or not. Additionally, I think that message testing is something that surveys can do reasonably well now, where, you know, we'll do a survey and we'll give a we'll give the respondent a variety of different things that the candidate might say and see which of them get the most positive reaction. It's tough to pose those questions when you're just analyzing lots of incoming data, but I think the sort of stuff like A-B testing, the stuff that Dan was talking about, where you can actually see how people are in real time reacting to different messages that you're putting out there. I think that the sort of A-B testing that you can do is really going to pass what traditional pollsters are able to do in terms of message testing. And I think sentiment analysis can also be great in terms of identifying new trends. As a pollster, I'm feeding a respondent a structured set of questions and seeing how they react, whereas I might not catch whatever the newest trend is, whatever the newest big issue is, if I, as a pollster, don't put it into my survey on the front end. I really think that people use a pollster to avoid guessing. They use a pollster in order to gain knowledge about the world around them to make better choices within the campaign. But I think that by using the sorts of tools that the rest of these folks on the panel have talked about, pollsters can begin to just, they're just one part of how campaigns no longer guess. And I'm very excited to see how my industry adapts and really begins to use some of the tools that these folks have been talking about to give candidates better information.
So I think that was an awesome overview of all the tools. Now, we know that are available, certainly in the space, to analyze data in the political arena. Now, a couple weeks ago in the New York Times, there was an article about Target and how they figured out a girl was pregnant because they marketed to her, a teenage girl was pregnant before her dad did, because they sent her stuff at home containing baby stuff, and her dad walked into Target and was like outraged, as how could you do this to my kid? And you know, then he wrote back or called back a couple weeks later and said, never mind, I was wrong about that. We're also seeing OkCupid's doing dating analysis. So using all the tools that you just described, and figuring also that the Obama campaign may be the quote unquote $1 billion campaign, if you had unlimited resources at your disposal, what would you want to find out that the current that you can't currently find out with unlimited resources?
I can take that first. I think I'll come at it from a slightly different perspective in that what I would do in the GOP primary, I think the one thing that we don't really have a very good understanding of at all is candidate preferences in a multi-candidate primary. And the ordering of preferences. And I think that there's a lot of very interesting A-B testing and experiments you can do online looking at support to kind of figure out exactly how candidate preference moves. Right now we're limited on surveys to just a first ballot and a second ballot. Okay, if that person drops out, who do you support? But that doesn't really, I think, truly capture the dynamic in a campaign. So I would love to throw a bunch of money at a problem like that.
Another thing I would also say that is new, and Josh, you talked about what may not be new necessarily, but we're in sort of the democratization of data. But a thing that's probably new this cycle is Facebook and all the data that they have on each individual. And if you can, you know, get them to click that Facebook Connect button, it's not just an authentication system. You can, you know, get them to authorize potential use of a lot of that data. How is social data, beyond sort of the sentiment analysis stuff, which we kind of, I think everyone on this stage probably agrees you can't predict an election based on tweets, but sort of this identity data that could be, that could in some ways disrupt, I think, the consumer database market, how do you see that playing out?
I think the Facebook question is really interesting. And when Dan showed the Pledge to Vote campaign from 2010, that was like a huge success, actually. And we got a really, really, really significant number of people right before the election to connect with us on Facebook. And I think that that in and of itself showed crazy potential for campaigns leveraging Facebook in a way that they had never done before. I think that obviously the question this year is this, that what data can we collect via people connecting on Facebook that we could actually use? And when I say that we could actually use, this is actually a really important point, because Facebook is really, as they should be, Facebook is very sensitive about what data you can use from Connect, and even if you get permission from it, what data you can use and how you can use it. So I think I'm sure there's going to be a lot of back and forths between the campaigns and Facebook on how, you know, what data could actually be leveraged, what data could actually be taken out of the social networks, presuming that there's permission, and imported into their national database of people. So whether that's Narwhal on the Obama side or whether that's the Truss on the Republican side. So, I mean, I think a lot of these questions just aren't, we don't know, and we're going to have to see sort of over the course of the year how much success the campaigns have in allowing people to connect and what data can be brought out of it, and then what data can actually legitimately be used. I think the one product that I would actually point to, and I know this isn't a product question, but that it makes really interesting use of Facebook is a product called Amicus, which for the first time actually lets you connect via Facebook, and then it's basically a call tool where you would ordinarily call random voters, but instead of calling random voters, you're calling your friends. So it's things like that that are really interesting, that yes, of course that makes sense, that rather than calling random people, you should call people you know. But we're actually able to do that by using Facebook Connect and then matching it to the voter file for the first time. So that's really interesting.
Great. There's a mic in the middle if anyone wants to line up for questions.
Hi, I'm Stacy from GigaOM. I'll talk louder. There's a lot of tools, and we saw this with like the Stop SOPA kind of action, where people started taking action and using digital means of doing it that automatically then can be tracked back for campaigns. Are you guys looking at using that kind of online activism in kind of, I don't know, talking with Twilio or Engine Advocacy or those kind of companies and really better pinpointing who's likely to take action on something, what they're taking action on, because it's digital, so it's trackable. Is anyone doing it?
Yeah. I would say on the speaking from the digital strategy side, that the actions that people take in a campaign are increasingly going to migrate online, that it's not that campaigns are no longer going to be about we're going to upload or offline data. That what was great about Engine Advocacy did was it was hooked directly into the phone system, so we knew all the calls that, you know, were being made. Same with VoIP being used in call centers on campaigns. We don't have to get people to report back to fill out a paper scan sheet. We know exactly how they talk to a voter and how many seconds they talk to a voter, and you can pivot that against other data.
Yeah, that's exactly right, that you actually have a transactional log of what calls people are making and how long they're calling people. I think the interesting thing about Twilio is that it's bringing it at a price that's far lower than historically, you know, having to do call dialers that are costing you a couple bucks for the whole call.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Looking back to the 2010 or 2008 election, what's one lesson you saw from the other side that you want to apply for this election?
I think the one I mentioned before is that Catalyst, being a central data resource for the left that was independent of the party structure, allowed independent organizations to have knowledge about who had been contacted and how frequently they had been contacted. It wasn't that they knew what other campaign had contacted them or even the nature of what they were talking about, but they were smarter in knowing that, hey, this group of voters, this chunk of voters right here, you know, the campaign has contacted them frequently. And so labor groups, especially the SEIU, was able to look at that voter map and say, okay, well, these people have not been contacted. And so we can really hit them. And so there was more efficiency across the left, across the voter contact world of the left. And I think that was an advantage of having data in an independent organization like Catalyst. And so the right, I think that's one thing that we're trying to do by moving the voter file to these independent organizations, and that we're trying to do better this year.
Hi, my name is Liz Meritz. I work for a software development and web design company, so we do a lot of multivariate testing and a lot of the technical end of things as well, but in the context of web users. So my question's kind of inherently technical. When you're sort of mining these best practices from all of the testing that you're doing, is there anything that you notice sort of provides a diminishing return? Like, it works really well in this one situation where it's sort of new or sort of novel, but then as you continue to use that practice, it sort of becomes less effective?
So this is something we see all the time with Optimizely and existing experiments that people run. And a great example is actually in 2008, we ran an experiment with the donate button in the upper right-hand corner. And we actually learned that it really matters who you are as an individual. If you had never signed up on our email list, or if you'd signed up but never donated, or if you had donated, all those three different segments actually responded very differently to the things we were testing. And, you know, in terms of diminishing returns, if somebody actually previously donated, the impact you can have in getting them to donate again by just changing some calls to action or words is actually it's less and less. You're much more likely to make an impact on somebody the first time they donate than on subsequent donations.
Can you comment on mobile as a platform? You said 46% of Americans are carrying a smartphone. I've seen a lot about online web optimization, but just can you comment on the role that as a platform is having in your thinking?
Sure. I think the one thing that I would say about mobile, and, you know, defer to the pollsters on questions of, you know, obviously cell phone use in general is fundamentally changing a lot of the landscape. But I would, you know, one thing that I'm really curious about seeing more of this year is as all of the campaigns are going to have their own mobile apps, I think the role of mobile notifications is actually going to start supplanting email a little bit for people who have these mobile apps installed. We did some very successful testing, but very small-scale testing on that in 2010, and I expect we'll see a lot of that this year.
So something that – this is my – if I had unlimited resources, what would I do? I would build an app that had an extensive panel of respondents to where I could really get a representative sample of what's going on out in the electorate, and I would use it – I mean, what's cool about smartphones is I don't just have to call someone and I don't just have to use voice to ask them questions and they – give me responses. I could do the sorts of things that now it takes me a focus group to do, where I could, you know, send somebody a video and have them respond, you know, from the line at the supermarket what they thought about that video. That's the kind of cool stuff that where I think smartphones are going to allow pollsters to ask people questions they couldn't ask before and get richer feedback that they couldn't get before, which will really expand what we're able to do in terms of giving strategic advice to campaigns.
2-minute warning, so last couple questions.
You touched on sharing data within the organization, but how about the reverse side of that? How concerned are you about data security, agents in your organization downloading data, and have you ever been hacked? And if you don't want to tell us, have you know people in your field that have been hacked and the state has been compromised?
We haven't been hacked, which is great, yet. We take data security very seriously. I mean, there's only... I'm sorry?
Not that you know of.
Not that we know of, yes. Very good qualifier. And just for anybody, that was not an invitation to try. So, but no, we take data security very, very seriously. I mean, and you do have to have, I think, rigorous protocols and testing. I mean, we've tested our system a few times to be sure of it. There's only, you know, one person in our company who has the keys to the kingdom. You know, I never work with a data set that has PII on it. And whenever I'm doing my modeling, it's always completely anonymized. So we take steps like that to ensure that data doesn't leak.
Yes, Ian Spencer, Red Edge. I guess this is tied to that last question. In the era of big data is also sort of the era of data privacy consciousness and people actually being aware that, wait a second, there's files of me out there. Is there, Josh, yeah, I think you hit on this slightly in terms of Facebook's terms of service. Is there a different expectation of privacy from the average, you know, visitor to a website with political data than there is necessarily with a regular consumer website or product?
Well, I think there is in some sense that when you're thinking about political organizations, they are reaching out to people that have not signed up, right? That they are at heart, they're using voter data, which means people have not opted in to voter data. And obviously, there's this big distinction on the digital side, right? That I would never recommend that an organization append email addresses and send emails to people that haven't opted in. But at the same time, I think political organizations, you know, at their heart, are reaching out to people that haven't opted in because they need to speak to voters. So I think there are different expectations, but I agree with Alex as well that it's actually, you know, it's something that you need to take very seriously.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Awesome panel. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.